The headlines, the Kremlin repeats its previous stance on the use of nuclear weapons, saying such arms will only be used if Russia is faced with an existential threat. Pakistani opposition supporters rally in Islamabad as a parliament prepares for a no-confidence vote against embattled Prime Minister Imran Khan. Also ahead, Iran welcomes a three-day ceasefire announced by Yemen's Supreme Political Council as an initiative to end the Saudi-led war and blockade. Thank you for joining us. My name is Kisumi Shahmati, and these are top stories this hour. The Kremlin spokesman says that Russia will only resort to nuclear weapons if its very existence is threatened.
But any outcome of the operation, of course, is not a reason for usage of a nuclear weapon. We have a security concept that very clearly states that only when there is a threat for existence of the state in our country, we can use, and we will actually use, nuclear weapons to eliminate the threat for the existence of our country.
Dmitry Peskov said not any scenario in the conflict with Ukraine will be the grounds for using a nuclear weapon. President Vladimir Putin last month ordered Russia's nuclear forces to be on high alert. The country has approximately 6,000 nuclear warheads, the largest stockpile in the world. Peskov also said Russia is convinced that NATO is a machine of a confrontation and not cooperation and security. He noted that Moscow does not accept the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. The tribunal has opened an investigation into possible war crimes in Ukraine, but its prosecutor says Russia has not responded to his request for contributions. We spoke to political commentator Scott Bennett to get his opinion. He believes the odds of Russia using nuclear weapons are very low.
Well, I don't think there's any chance of Russia using nuclear weapons in an offensive capacity. It is making the declaration that it will not tolerate any attacks upon it, be it in the form of conventional weapons, nuclear weapons, or, as we've recently discovered, biological and chemical weapons. So I think Russia is recognizing that it is doubling down on its economic war against NATO and the United States for its declarations of war by demanding oil be produced in rubles and sold on that monetary system. Of course, this is being challenged by Europe. So this is a Russian positioning itself for defense. But I don't think there's any real danger. There is almost a laughable hypocrisy in NATO and the United Nations and the World Criminal Court trying to charge Russia with war crimes, because as we're seeing every day, the evidence of war crimes is coming out that the Biden administration and members of the United States government have been involved in funding war crimes in the form of biological and chemical weapons.
U.S. President Joe Biden says Washington's policy towards Moscow remains unchanged in the wake of a controversial statement that President Vladimir Putin, quote, cannot remain in power.
Number one, I'm not walking anything back. The fact of the matter is, I was expressing the more outrage I felt toward the way Putin is dealing and the actions of this man, just brutality. Half the children in Ukraine. I just come from being with those families. But I want to make it clear, I wasn't then, nor am I now, articulating a policy change. I was expressing the moral outrage that I feel, and I make no apologies.
For the 21st century, once again facing increased competition.
Biden also said the last thing he wants is to engage in a land war or a nuclear war with Russia. The statement comes as administration officials rush to clarify that the White House was not advocating for regime change in Russia. This after Moscow labeled Biden's comments alarming. During a visit to Warsaw on Saturday, Biden called the Russian president a, quote, butcher who cannot remain in power. The White House then tried to downplay the remarks, and Biden himself said he was not calling for regime change in Russia. Washington's ambassador to NATO also echoed the U.S. president. The UN chief says the solution to the Russia-Ukraine conflict is political and not humanitarian, adding that the global body is seeking a ceasefire between the two neighbors. Antonio Guterres hoped the UN humanitarian chief would travel to both Moscow and Kiev as soon as possible to explore the grounds for a humanitarian ceasefire. Over a month of Russia's attacks on Ukraine has taken a heavy toll on civilian lives and infrastructure. Ukrainian officials say almost 5,000 people have been killed in the southern city of Mariupol alone since Russian forces laid siege on it. Kiev says the war has so far cost close to $565 billion in terms of damage to infrastructure, lost economic growth, and other factors. Ukraine's officials also say they have proof Russian forces have used banned cluster bombs in the two southern regions of Odessa and Kherson. Moscow has already denied such allegations. Our correspondent, Johnny Miller, was in Ukraine last week to cover the conflict with Russia, but he cut his trip short and is now in the Hungarian capital, Budapest. He says the security situation inside Ukraine is too dangerous for journalists critical of the government or the NATO alliance.
But I recognize that the security situation inside Ukraine was too dangerous for certain journalists. A few days ago, the Ukrainian government banned most opposition parties in the country. They've banned most media in the country, except for their one central channel and some foreign reporters. But in Ukraine right now, there's a feeling of anybody who reports in any way against or critical of the Ukrainian government or critical of NATO, then they can be seriously under threat. My own position on the conflict, I'm against Russia's invasion, but also very critical of NATO's involvement, of their pushing into the east, of them sending arms to Ukraine. Also have some criticism of certain elements within the Ukrainian army, Azov battalion and the ultra-nationalists and the Nazis, an openly neo-Nazi battalion within the Ukrainian army who are doing some of the major fighting on the east. If you're inside Ukraine and you want to cover that story or criticize those kind of stories, then you're under serious threat. And indeed, even if you voice the opinion that in some way NATO can be in part blamed for this crisis, indeed, even if you espouse the view that is being commonly understood now that Ukraine is largely a proxy war between Russia and NATO, and that Ukraine and the Ukrainian people are being very much held hostage to this proxy war, even if you espouse that very mild opinion, that's against the Ukrainian army. Certainly certain elements of the European anti-war left, like Noam Chomsky and other figures, have been documenting how NATO has been pushing into the east for many years, and Ukraine is being funded by NATO. And some people argue that NATO has in some way provoked this war by pushing NATO further and arming troops, arming the Ukrainian army. In the West, if you voice that opinion, you're told that you're a Putin apologist. Inside Ukraine, whether you're a foreigner or Ukrainian, if you voice that opinion, frankly, you could be in danger of your life.
Supporters of opposition political parties in Pakistan have staged a rally against Prime Minister Imran Khan in the capital, Islamabad. The rally came hours after the parliament took up a no-confidence motion pushed by opposition lawmakers to remove Khan from power. The House will begin a debate on the motion on Thursday, and a vote will be held within 7 days. Khan lost a parliamentary majority with a series of defections from his Tehreek-e-Insaf party, leaving him reliant on coalition allies to stay in power. Khan's opponents believe that they have enough votes to unseat him. Pakistan is currently grappling with soaring inflation and unemployment, with accusations of corruption and mismanagement plaguing the government. Khan says a foreign-funded plot is underway to topple him. Our correspondent Kamran Yusuf says the demonstrations against Imran Khan are part of the political turmoil in Pakistan.
As far as rallies are concerned, this is, of course, part of the overall political tension that is brewing in Pakistan since opposition moved a no-confidence motion. We saw a couple of days back, Prime Minister Imran Khan showed his street power in Islamabad, and in response to government's rally, opposition parties last night also gathered on the main highway in the capital, Islamabad, where opposition leaders made fiery speeches and were confident that their move to remove Prime Minister Imran Khan through a vote of no confidence will succeed. As far as the vote of no confidence is concerned, the formal process was kicked off yesterday. Now the session of the National Assembly, the lower house of Pakistan's parliament, will meet again on Thursday when the debate will start on the vote of no confidence. As per the Pakistani constitution, once the resolution is tabled inside the National Assembly, the voting has to take place within 7 days. So we expect that by early next week, the voting will take place and we will have the answer whether Prime Minister Imran Khan will survive.
Iran welcomes Yemen's new peace initiative to end the Saudi-led war. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says the proposed plan shows the determination of Sana'a to bring an end to the war and blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia through political means. He hoped that by giving priority to humanitarian issues and promoting the exchange of prisoners, the crisis would be resolved. Sana'a has announced a unilateral ceasefire, saying it is ready for a permanent truce if Riyadh withdraws its forces, halts supporting local militia, and ends its siege. Since March 2015, the war has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, either directly or indirectly. The UN says the war and blockade have made Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis. As Europe continues to struggle for an alternative source of oil to replace Russian crude, Yemen's war has once again hit the headlines. This after a series of retaliatory strikes by the Yemeni army successfully hit Saudi oil infrastructure last week. With petrol prices reaching epic highs, could the Saudi-led war on Yemen cause more economic hardship on European consumers? Robert Carter reports.
In the aftermath of Yemen's blistering retaliatory strike on Saudi Arabia's Aramco oil facilities, crude oil prices shot up by over $120 a barrel. Yemen's military spokesperson revealed that the operation had been carried out in response to continued Saudi-led aggression.
Yemen will not hesitate to widen its military operation until the end of the aggression and breaking of the siege. Allah is witness to what we say.
With the threat of future attacks looming, many fear that Saudi's seemingly endless war on Yemen could negatively contribute to economic instability in Europe.
Now we are seeing it's affecting the pounds and the pennies. It's not just Britain. Look at the price of the gasoline and the petrol in the United States, in Germany, everywhere else. Everything is connected, you know, and I think the fact of the matter is today's world, we can't commit these sort of atrocities on one side and think it's not going to come and bite us back later on. And now we are seeing very clear indication of direct impact on our pounds and pennies.
With the relationship between Russia and the West continuing to crumble, Riyadh hopes that it can use this opportunity and Europe's desperate need to replace Russian oil to its own advantage. However, with Yemen's ability to hit key Saudi oil infrastructure at will, serious questions are being raised about the reliability of Saudi as an oil-producing partner. Robert Carter, London.
Turning now to Peru, where President Pedro Castillo has survived an impeachment vote in Congress. Overall, 55 out of 130 lawmakers voted in favor of the impeachment, but the Congress needed 87 votes to oust Castillo. This will prevent a new political crisis in the short term, although Castillo's administration has been turbulent anyway, with four cabinets during its less than a year in office. He's been facing accusations of graft that he denies. Similarly, last year, the president survived an impeachment attempt. Back then, he argued that he had not broken the law since taking office and called for unity to deal with the political and economic crisis. Polls show Castillo is facing a plummeting approval rating, hovering around 25%. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who celebrates the ancient festivity of Nowruz. On behalf of myself and all my colleagues here at IRIB English Radio, we wish you a wonderful Nowruz, full of happiness and prosperity.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, in the previous episode, you heard the story of Imam Khomeini's residence in the holy city of Qom with Lady Khadija Saqafi, whose father was one of the renowned ulema in Tehran. Today, we will touch upon Imam Khomeini's simple way of living according to his wife. Stay tuned, please. Imam Khomeini's fourth house in Qom was much smaller than the previous ones. It was in the poor neighborhood of the city. After 3 years of residing in the third house, the Imam had to leave to somewhere else. Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Sadiq Lavasani, who used to help Imam Khomeini in such affairs, tried to find a new house for him. Due to the Imam's poverty, he had to rent a smaller house. Lady Khadija Saghafi says in this regard, Mr. Ruhollah Khomeini had found it better to do so. He was right. There was no income after all. I mean, it was not regular and continuous. He would not get the stipend either. And there was no other money. When he had seen this house, it seems that he didn't like it. He came and told me, You two go and see it. I said, No, it is okay for me if you like it. I wish I had gone and seen it. In that case, I would not step in that house. When he had told Mr. Sayed Sadegh that the house was not suitable, he asked why. The rent of this house is 3 tomans per month, while the current house is 5 tomans. Is it bad to save 2 tomans every month? Khadija Saghafi was a patient and rational woman. Thus, she didn't disagree and never disputed with the imam to pressure him. She lived in this humble house from the age of 19 to 27. Yet, she never complained, as she knew well that her husband was in economic pressure. She relates, on those years, Mr. Ruhollah knew my temperament well and knew how to behave to calm me. I always lived with him sincerely and purely. He would always compensate our poverty with kindness and expression of love. Of course, he never believed that we were in bad condition because the condition of the students at that time was worse than ours. The imam believed that one is not poor as long as he doesn't eat carrion. He would tell me, Thank God, we have always been well off. Imam Khomeini had such a lofty spirit that he didn't let the robbers of their house be exposed and insulted among people. He told his wife, They're good people and the robbery had originated in their need. We should pardon them. She pardoned them verbally, but the imam told her that she had to forgive them in her heart. In a similar incident, a woman had stolen Lady Saghafi's handbag in Najaf. The lady knew her and wanted to pursue her and get back the handbag and its contents. But Imam Khomeini dissuaded her as he was very careful to not to tarnish people's repute. He knew that the woman was poor and he didn't like to disgrace her among people. This spirit of forgiveness was in circumstances that Ruhollah and Khadija had economic problems themselves. Lady Khadija had become weak when she was expecting her third child. She says, At the time of Ahmad's birth, I was so weak that I couldn't even moan. And at the moment of childbirth, there was no one except my 9-year-old daughter. As soon as seeing my fainting, Siddiqah had run and informed her father, saying that I had died. It was at the midnight that I regained my consciousness of the pain in my neck. I saw that Mr. Ruhollah was massaging my neck vessels. I opened my eyes, but fainted again. This happened several times, but I had no ability to talk because I had not eaten anything for several days. Imam Khomeini and his wife were so magnanimous that they never asked anyone for financial help, despite dire need. Lady Khadija relates a memoir on this. When she had gone to Tehran for her stomach ulcer, she had paid a visit to her sister whose husband was a colonel. As she saw Khadija's son, Ahmad, in poor condition, she told her, What kind of life is this? Winter, snow, and tattered shoes. Khadija was very upset and could not forget those bitter remarks for years. Imam Khomeini was in poor economic conditions, but he would not give up worship and studying. Lady Khadija says, "The whole thought and love of Mr. Ruhollah was studying and teaching. He used to wake up for midnight prayer. Then he would be engaged in studying and then teaching till night, that he would sleep again. He had said several times, 'I do not prefer anything to my ritual duties and studying.'" Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini was a very kind person with his family. He would never let the family affected by daily debates between him and his wife. He would always be the first to solve differences and make peace. Ms. Fatemeh Tabatabai, Imam Khomeini's daughter-in-law and wife of Haj Ahmad, says in this regard that when she and Haj Ahmad had gone to visit the Imam for the first time after marriage, he left them for midnight prayer. He told them, "You can speak with the lady, my wife. I have to take care of my affair." Ms. Tabatabai says, "I asked Ahmad in surprise when the Imam had gone. Ahmad answered that he had gone for midnight prayer. I had expected him to be more with his daughter-in-law and grandson, whom he was visiting for the first time, but he told us to rest as we could visit him again the following day."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to another edition of The Spotlight. Now, the Russian-Ukraine conflict has already had an immense impact on economic activities and inflation through higher energy and commodity prices. But recent developments suggest that it will also lead to a shift in international commerce as well by reinforcing the anti-dollar axis. Russia now wants what it calls unfriendly countries to pay for Russian gas in rubles, a demand that has sent European gas prices surging. Despite opposing to the move, it appears that the West has difficulty in circumventing an energy superpower. In this edition of Spotlight, we will be discussing the impact of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, particularly on global energy supply. Now, in this edition, we have two guests from New York and Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
And I would like to start with our guest from New York. Now, Russia is insisting on receiving gas payments in rubles. To what extent do you think the currency switch is justified in the wake of sanctions imposed on Moscow?
Oh, it's extremely justified. I mean, the U.S. has seized Russian assets, at odds with its previous promises to exercise financial fiduciary responsibility with regard to those assets. And Russia is quite alarmed, and therefore is clearly in the process of transferring itself out of dollar-based assets into ruble-based assets that presumably would be beyond the reach of U.S. financial authorities. And what's more important is that other nations are getting the same message and responding accordingly. So so not only is political power breaking up around the globe, but financial power as well, as countries like China and Russia take steps to protect themselves against U.S. seizures of this sort.
Thank you. Now to our guests in Brussels. How much do you think this retaliatory move by Moscow would be effective, considering the explanations that we just heard?
I think it will be effective, because Europe has no choice. I think you have a lot of whistling in the dark here. People like Chancellor Scholz, who's giving a bright image to the possibilities of Germany and other European countries getting around Russian supplies, or the commissioner of the European Union, von der Leyen, who has instructed all member states of the European Union not to comply with the Russian demand. But that's total folly. The Russians have made it fairly clear that they will turn off the switch, which means that Europe will land in a disaster. The issue is not whether prices for gas will go up. They will go up. The question is, will there be any gas? And in the immediate days, weeks, and months, there will be no gas. And European industry will shut down. People in their homes will not have heating. And it's all completely unnecessary. It is pure stubbornness and the mistaken belief that Europe has greater leverage with Russia than Russia has with Europe. It will fail.
Back to New York. G7 countries have not accepted Russia's condition, and at least not just yet. Do you believe, like our guest from Brussels, that eventually they will have to?
Yes, I think that Russia has the upper hand. I mean, energy prices are rising, and that benefits energy exporters like Russia or the Persian Gulf states. So Russia has the advantage, and Europeans are at the disadvantage. So they'll have no choice. Their choices will be to face a drastic cutoff in energy supplies, which will lead their industry in ruins, and will also lead to severe political, turmoil, give in to Russian demands and begin paying for natural gas in rubles.
Okay, so all of this, I believe, is spelling a new economic world order. Let's go back to Brussels to Gilbert Doctorow, independent and international affairs analyst. So Putin is obviously not isolated despite the Western sanctions. At least in Asia, we know that he has a handful of partners that support its de-dollarization policies. Are you looking at a new economic world order here?
Well, I believed from the very beginning of this conflict that a new world order would emerge. I have to admit that I didn't anticipate it would take precisely the form it's taking. I expected there would be a bipolar world with Europe and the United States on one side and Russia and China on the other. What I see now forming is a constellation of the West, headed by the United States, with the European Union, with the UK, Canada, Australia, and a few other odd countries, facing against the Russia, China, India, and the Global South. Now, the Indian element here is extremely important and could not be anticipated. Everyone was talking about China. It was China, China, China. The Chinese are backing Putin, and that and the support from President Xi made the whole invasion possible. However, in terms of real open and transparent assistance, Russia has benefited much more in recent days from India, because Russia and India concluded an agreement whereby the now fast expanding Russian sales of crude oil to India will be settled in rupees. And the rupees will be used by the Russians to invest in Indian state bonds. Now, if you look at it, that is essentially the type of formula that lay behind the petrodollar from the 1970s. So the uniqueness of the American dollar as the world's reserve currency is being challenged directly in the latest agreements between India and Russia, and we may expect them to be a model for future agreements between Russia and China.
Now, thank you very much. Mr. Lazar, as we just heard Mr. Doctorow pointing out to the fact that we were expecting a Russia-China partnership, but joining that partnership is now India. There is also Turkey and Iran in the line. So India has reportedly expressed interest in an alternative to SWIFT, and that would allow it to trade with countries under U.S. sanctions. All this is pointing to a very big shift. Do you believe that this is possible? How likely is it to happen?
Oh, it's very possible. And I think the more the U.S. pushes, the likelier it will be. SWIFT essentially is a giant email system, which allows members to engage in financial transactions, you know, across the globe with a few clicks of the mouse. But the U.S. controls it, and the U.S. had previously run it in a relatively objective, neutral fashion. But the politicization of SWIFT, which has occurred since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, shows the U.S. is not going to do that anymore. So therefore, it makes it all the more urgent for other countries which don't want to, you know, be at the mercy of U.S. Financial blackmail to establish an alternate system that they will control, that will accomplish the same ends, but will do so while removing the threat of U.S. political interference.
Well, thank you very much. Back to Mr. Doctorow. Now, let's discuss something that is very important at this point. How do you assess U.S. efforts to lessen European countries' dependence on Russian gas?
Well, that has been a stated U.S. objective since early in the Trump administration. There's nothing new in that. The question is, to what extent the United States can provide the gas, which is limited. It takes time to ramp up production and to add super tankers to carry the gas. And at the end of the day, everyone knows that pipeline gas, is much cheaper intrinsically than the compressed liquid gas. That is simply a question of transport costs. The liquefaction and the regasification, all of those are expensive and capital-intensive operations. So the United States plan was fine words, but it's not easy to follow through on them.
So, Mr. Lazar, adding to that, let's also point to the Persian Gulf littoral states and the comments that have been made recently by countries like Qatar, the UAE. Well, they're obviously not capable of replacing Russian gas, and they're not willing to either. We just heard from Qatar that said it will not be able to replace Russian gas, and also OPEC Plus did not back this policy. So what does this spell for Europe?
I think the U.S. is in big trouble. I mean, I think we're seeing the eclipse of U.S. global hegemony. Shortly after the invasion, there was a vote in the UN General Assembly, to condemn Russia for its actions. And really, three-fourths of the world's population vote either abstained or voted no on that resolution. So the U.S. is facing a huge rebellion, a huge mutiny, a global mutiny against its power. And the reason is very simple. I mean, the U.S. has been on a rampage for 25 years. Its behavior has been hypocritical in the extreme. Everybody knows that. And I might add, the people of Iran know that especially. And so everyone knows that, and people have reached the breaking point. They are just tired of it. They don't want to put up with it any longer. And now the system is coming apart at the seams. And so I think we're seeing the breakup of the old order and a crystallization of a new kind of financial structure.
Now, this question is one that I would like both of you to answer. What other options do Europeans have in terms of energy supplies? Mr. Doctorow.
Commit suicide. What they're doing now is extremely foolhardy, and I can't believe the incompetence of European leadership. But when you look at them one by one, you begin to understand. Who are these people? Ursula von der Leyen, the head of the European Commission, she is by education a gynecologist. Her knowledge of economics is obviously close to zero. And she has usurped the power of the sovereign state members of the European Union to instruct them not to buy Russian gas for rubles. This is madness. You look at the single biggest member state in terms of economy, Germany, and Chancellor Scholz. He was the mayor of Hamburg, and his mental breadth width is that of a German mayor. He had zero experience as a federal administrator, and he's speaking in a mindless way. His cabinet, which was put together by opportunism, to get to seize power, and by bringing in Greens and others who have no common agenda with his own party, was only opportunistic. And the result is total incompetence. Unfortunately, that is a widespread situation in Europe, and it explains the lemming behavior that we see now. I think of last week's crash of the Chinese 737. It went straight down. And that's what Europe is doing now. It is going vertically down and accelerating.
So, Mr. Lazar, you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I do. I'd phrase it a bit differently. Olaf Scholz, the German chancellor, was the candidate of the German Socialist Party, the Social Democrats. This is the same party which in 1914 essentially agreed to support the war effort of Kaiser Wilhelm, plunging Europe into a world war which led to something on the order of 10 million deaths. Essentially, the Social Democrats in the person of Olaf Scholz are doing the same thing. They are going along with Joe Biden's war drive. They are not raising a peep of opposition. And this war drive, if allowed to continue, will plunge Europe into the same kind of catastrophe.
So you also, like Mr. Doctorow, believe that Europeans have no other options?
They do have options. Their option is to put an end to this madness, to try to push for a negotiated settlement in the Ukraine, and one which respects Russia's entirely legitimate security concerns, and also tackles the problem of rampant neo-Nazism in the Western Ukraine.
Okay, so Mr. Doctorow, you talked about how Europeans are nosediving, but the main question for all of us outside Europe is how will any fallout affect global energy prices? Should we prepare ourselves for oil prices above $200 per barrel?
Look, the former energy minister that served for 10 years in that capacity in Russia, Mr. Novak, who is today the deputy prime minister, said a couple of weeks ago that if Europeans continue to behave as they are now, the price of a barrel will be $300. And he knows a lot better the economics of the oil business, much better than Madame von der Leyen or Mr. Scholz or Mr. Macron. They all are amateurs.
Okay, and Mr. Lazar, your opinion, should we look at oil prices above $200 per barrel or $300, as our other guest suggested?
I'm very bad when it comes to financial predictions like that. But yes, I think the price will continue upward as these tensions mount. I mean, U.S. policy since 1980 has been to control the global energy markets by controlling the Persian Gulf, and that is now falling apart as not only Iran but also the Gulf states, you know, look to allies in China and Russia, and the U.S. finds itself shut out. So the U.S. is facing a failure all around in the Gulf, in the energy markets in general, in the European Union. Joe Biden is really on the edge of the precipice.
And as you mentioned, we are looking at a multipolar economy rather than a bipolar or even one simply controlled by the United States. Mr. Doctor, would you like to comment on that, this multipolar scene that we're looking at?
Well, exactly the constellation is difficult to predict. But I'd like to add one further comment to my remarks on the incompetence of European leaders. No country has a monopoly on stupidity. And I think we have to take a look back to Washington and who is sitting in the Oval Office. We have a half-wit. We have a senile president, and his handlers know that. And when he makes these stupid, offensive, and potentially inflammatory remarks that he's made about the leader of the world's other nuclear superpower, watch out. We are in very dangerous territory.
Okay, and Mr. Lazar, are we looking at a multipolar economic system now? And who are these economic powers in the new order?
Oh, we are definitely looking at a multipolar economic system. And the powers will be China first and foremost, Russia in terms of energy, India, which is clearly a rising economic power. And that is proceeding hand in hand with the breakup of political power as well. I mean, look at if India sides with China, then the so-called Quad, which was the anti-Chinese alliance the U.S. is assembling in the Western Pacific, that obviously will be in ruins. So U.S. policy is failing there as well. I mean, Joe Biden is really an incompetent who has overplayed his hand, and the U.S. is really teetering on the edge of a major disaster.
Thank you very much, Mr. Doctorow. To wrap up this discussion, would you like to also tell us who you think will be global economic powers in this new economic system?
Well, let me just clarify. Yes, Russia will be a major power in the energy field. That is dictated by resources, competences, and markets. However, it would be unrealistic at this stage to speak about Russia as a major economic power. It simply has too much to do to expand its industrial base, to fill in all of the holes in its products and technologies and services, which were till now filled in by Western suppliers. So the major powers economically will be, of course, the United States, that goes without question, India, China, and a number of other countries, including assuming that the difficulties Iran is experiencing are overcome, there will be more players, not in the first league, but in the second league. And they will have an influence on the working of the board of directors of the globe.
Well, thank you very much. That was Mr. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst from Brussels. And we also had with us Daniel Lazar, journalist and author out in New York. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for sharing your thoughts on this edition of The Spotlight.
My pleasure.
And thanks for following us.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Joining me in the studio today is a dear friend and esteemed guest speaker, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, I welcome you and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Our question today is quite an interesting one, one that I myself have wondered about a lot, and I'm sure many others have also thought this very same thing. And the question, it is as follows. Considering that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, He is everywhere, and He is not bound to any one specific place, why then do we, when praying or supplicating or performing qunut in our prayers, raise our head and hands towards the sky?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yeah, this is a very interesting question, and it was asked by the companions of the Imams and even non-Muslims from the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam too, which means that it was an important question at that time too. So before that, yes, we do that during the qunut in the prayer, but doesn't mean that we cannot supplicate to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala without,
Raising our heads and hands towards the sky.
So for sure we can do that. We can close our eyes. We can, without raising our hands, we can do that. So it's not a part and parcel of the nature of
it's not a requirement.
Exactly.
Right.
Now, why then, putting our hands and pointing toward the earth. We just raise it toward the heavens we do not look at the earth, we look at the heaven. This is a reality. As far as I check the narrations, we can find two answers to this question. Now, according to Hisham ibn Hakam, one of the companions of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, once an atheist came to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam and asked him about the verse Ar-Rahmanu ala al-Arsh istawa, which is one of the verses which somehow some people understand it as a kind of anthropomorphic image of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
He has a throne that he sits upon.
And the Imam explained that no, Allah does not need any place. Then that atheist, who was very clever, said that, so if he doesn't any place, then why do you raise your hands toward the heavens when you're saying your prayer?
It is a good question.
Yes, a good question.
Yes.
Now, the Imam alayhi salam said that, ذَلِكَ فِي عِلْمِهِ وَإِحَاطَتِهِ وَقُدْرَتِهِ سَوَى. As long as the knowledge and power of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala are concerned, it doesn't make any difference whether you raise your hand toward the heavens or in any other direction.
From that perspective.
It doesn't make any difference. وَلَكِنَّهُ عَزَّ وَجَلْ أَمَرَ أَوْلِيَاءَهُ وَعِبَادَهُ بِرَفْعَ أَيْدِهِمْ إِلَى السَّمَاءِ نَهْوَ الْعَرْشِ. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has commanded the people, the servants, the righteous servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to raise their hands toward heaven So, which means that this is one of the etiquette of prayer.
So what's his throne, to be more precise?
Yeah. But, I mean, my point is that raising our hands toward the sky is not something that the Muslims, they brought it to the religion, no.
Like
they,
in other religions, that were symbolic to face these heavens and sky.
I will talk about the symbolic part as well. But before that, we have this command by the Imams of the Ahl Bayt that this is one of the etiquette of prayer, just to raise your hands toward the sky. So what is the reason? لَأَنَّهُ جَعَلَهُ مَعْدَنَ الرِّزْقِ. Now, this is one of the answers given by Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, that the treasure of sustenance comes to you from heaven. So according to this narration and some similar narrations, one of the philosophies that people raise hand toward the heaven is that a part of our sustenance comes from the heaven.
And this is not to be understood literally, like the money, it comes from heaven.
Yeah, I mean,
of course,
one of the best examples is the rain. Without water, we cannot imagine
right.
of any blessing on the earth.
That's the literal meaning.
Yeah.
Right.
So, according to this explanation from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, the heaven is ma'adin al-rizq, the treasure of the sustenance, of the rizq.
Right.
Then the Imam continues and says that this is what we understand from the Quran and the narrations of the Prophet who said, "Irfa'u aydiyakum ila Allahi azza wa jal." Raise your hand toward Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And the last point mentioned by Imam Sadiq alayhi salam in this narration is that وَهَذَا يَجْمَعُ عَلَيْهِ فِرَقُ الْأُمَّةِ كُلَّهَا. All the Islamic denominations agree on this. So there is no doubt about...
Right. So we do not have any Muslims who lower their hands towards
exactly.
the earth.
So this is one narration in this regard. And the second narration which refers to the same point, the same answer, is from Imam Ali alayhi salam. He said that after your prayer, raise your hand toward the heaven and engage in supplication. A man asked the Imam that, isn't it the case that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is everywhere, is present everywhere, he's omnipresent? The Imam said, of course he is. Then he said that why we need to raise our hands toward the heaven.
Right.
And then the Imam recited the verse, وَفِي السَّمَاءِ رِزْقُكُمْ وَمَا تُوْحَدُونَ. Your rizq, according to this verse, is in the heaven. Again, it may refer to rain as one of the best examples of the sustenance,
right.
but we may think of other things like sun and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So, according to these narrations from the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, because of the fact that one of the main treasures for divine blessings is from heaven, we are commanded by the infallible Imams to raise our hands. This is the first answer.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
The second answer is that this act done by the people, by the Muslims, is, I mean, symbolically speaking, is a kind of act of showing respect and humility. Imagine, as a poor person, you go to a rich person, and what do you do? I mean, you are not going to order him as if you are standing, he is sitting, and you
right.
order him, give me something.
He isn't your servant,
yeah.
for example. Right?
I mean, it is very normal that you may raise your hand toward that person and ask him for help, for money. So symbolically speaking, I mean, as a poor person, you may even knee before that rich person, raise your hands toward
right.
him for help. So...
Which you shouldn't do, by the way, just to clarify.
Yeah.